just another manic Sunday.
I wish it was Sunday.
It is, I just said that.
Just another manic Sunday.
KUSF in San Francisco, and wow, it's just another Menace Sunday, and this is show number 3, still in its infancy, but kind of fun. Dennis the Menace, your host here, and for those of you who have not listened to this version of the insanity that I like to do, here's how it works. Hour number 1, an interview with an artist that we just think is cool. Well, I think is cool. Hour number 2, all new music a la Dennis the Menace. Well, the intro song pretty much sums up who you're about to hear from in the next hour or so, and some of his guest DJ music just blows me away, but the things he has to talk about, rock and roll, is even more phenomenal. For the next hour, enjoy Marshall Crenshaw, and we are going to go right to the interview right now.
Hey, how you doing, Dennis?
Would you sign in, please?
Marshall Crenshaw.
Okay. I can't see your signature or anything. Anything you'd like to sign in with other than that? Like, you know, singer, songwriter, pop, supreme, something?
Yeah, sure.
Or not.
I'm here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you're here because you are touring behind a new, we can't say, I hate saying CD, so I'm just going to say record.
Yeah, it is a record.
Yeah, the whole, you know, CD thing.
Well, it's a CD and a record.
It is. It's come out as both, which is... Has it come out on vinyl? Have they put it out on vinyl?
No, but, you know, a CD is a record, you know?
Indeed. Well, they, you know, the whole new trendy thing now is going back to releasing it on vinyl, like 180-gram vinyl.
Yeah.
So they can sell it for more than the CD.
Oh, really? For more than the CD?
Gosh. Yeah, yeah, because it's a collectible now.
Well, you know, I would do that if I could. I don't think the record company would go for it.
But well, we'll talk to Razor and Ty and see if they're willing to do it.
I used to think that, you know, back in the 80s when I was... Are we doing the interview
No,
now?
No, we're fine. I was just checking the meters. Don't let me distract you. Sorry about that.
I was going to say that when I was putting out records, you know, vinyl records, I used to always be disappointed in the way the vinyl sounded as compared to the tapes, you know, the way I heard the stuff in the studio. Not because I don't like vinyl, but because, you know, at that time they were using really kind of cheap vinyl, real thin vinyl, you know, and it just sort of, it really couldn't deliver the goods the way a 180-gram vinyl disc would do, you know.
Oh, I remember and this is dating everybody, but this band, the Guess Who, that was on RCA. And
she's come undone.
Exactly.
In
the 70s, RCA came up with this thing called the Flexi Disc.
Yeah.
And it was to say vinyl. And you could take the thing, you could play on it. You could play Timey Kangaroo Downsport, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
On that disc.
I remember that.
And the noise, just the silence between the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always one that had a good needle and everything else and a good amplifier. And it's a bloop, 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 bloop. And you know that's behind the music and you're thinking, boy, that's really killing the rhythm track.
Sure, sure.
So, yeah, times have changed. So, Robert Gordon, Gin Blossoms, Bill Lloyd, Men at Work, Bette Midler. I had to throw that one in the middle.
Men at Work.
You were involved with them and some. They covered you. They covered something of yours.
No, that's a mistake.
Are you sure you've never seen the checks on that?
No.
It was listed somewhere. It was on your website in the bio. It was there.
No, that's incorrect.
Uh-oh. Nitty Gritty Dirt Band.
Yeah.
Favorite cover. Who's covered your stuff better than you?
Jeez.
Or who's covered it respectably?
Well, I mean, I like them all. Just, you know,
good answer.
It's flattering.
Good answer.
There was this song I wrote with Was Not Was that I really liked a lot. That
Don's incredible, yeah.
There was a Taiwanese version of You're My Favorite Waste of Time.
There you go.
That I really liked. You know, it was kind of off the wall, funny. I liked the Gin Blossoms thing. That was nice.
Yeah, that was lovely.
Yeah. Who else? Oh, Kelly Willis had a country single on one of my tunes a few years ago. That was pretty good.
Well, that's a kind of a great segue because, and it's funny because I'll say to whoever it may be, I'm going to see Marshall Crenshaw. And I remember when I first met my wife, it was probably just a few months afterwards, and I said, "You want to go see Marshall Crenshaw?" And she said, "Who?" And I'm not putting my wife down in terms of her musical taste because she's got excellent musical taste.
Right.
But, you know, there's different levels of reality and what people know about. But, you know, and they'll say, "Well, Marshall Crenshaw, what does he play?" And then I get into this, "Well, let me try to explain this to you. It's based in this incredible history of music, and he, you know, he pulls from all sorts of different things, but and then, of course, my favorite thing was on allmusic.com. You know how they do the categories on there?
Mm-hmm.
You are college rock /power pop/new wave.
What is that?
Well, I don't know. But that's what I'm... college rock's kind of cool.
That's so bogus. You know?
You're college rock.
That is completely bogus.
And I'm thinking, wow, that's kind of a weird category. And, so, you know, and then power pop, well, yes, of course, Whenever You're On My Mind is featured on that, you know, on that Poptopia...
Oh, true, yeah.
You know, thing that came out. So they've lumped you together with, you know, with all sorts of things there.
Right.
But so when people, you know, ask you, what the heck do you tell them?
Well, if I'm talking to somebody and I know that they only have a kind of a vague concept of, you know, rock music, I just say, well, it kind of sounds like the Beatles. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's a real general...
That works.
Description that I give to somebody who I know, if I make a reference to somebody more obscure, like anybody else, you know, that they won't get it. And then sometimes I say, I don't know. Usually when somebody asks me to describe my stuff, I do what I'm doing now, which is to stammer and flounder.
Right, right.
But, you know, it's just... But it just sounds like me, you know.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It does, but that really is a good point, is it does sound like you. And when a Marshall Crenshaw record comes on the radio or on somebody's stereo or whatever it may be, it does, and it is you. And I think that's pretty darn why you've been at this so long, and you know, still doing it and doing it well. I mean,
thank you. You know, I'll be honest. I don't like to get. I hate it when somebody calls my stuff power pop. And I don't like to be lumped in with other stuff called power pop.
Power pop is a dangerous term, because I think that if She Loves You by the Beatles came out today,
right,
they'd lump it in as power pop.
Well, it'd probably be a fair description of She Loves You and all that. But, you know, a lot of the latter-day stuff is just kind of, to me, it's just kind of suburban Anglophile music, you know, and stuff that I can't really relate to.
Oh, and I'm going to get there in a second, because there's always that, what do you think of today's music? But we'll wait. We'll build a little conversation before we get there, because that just gets kind of crazy. But that said, back to the power pop thing.
Right.
You know, looking at the stuff that I love of yours, be it Cynical Girl or Monday Morning Rock or of course, whenever, you know, you're on my mind.
Yeah.
Why wasn't that a number one record? What's wrong with America? I know it's dumb to ask you that question. I should be asking me that question, but, you know.
You know,
I mean, it bubbled under or something like that, right?
Yeah. Well, it was kind of, I mean, let's go from the premise that it was a good record.
Yeah.
Which I think it was.
Yeah.
Because, you know, someone could say, well, it was the wrong, you know. It
was the wrong time.
Yeah, something like that.
1983 was the wrong time for, you know.
But I was just in a bad place politically with Warner Brothers Records at that time. I mean, to give you an example, like, that song did manage to sneak its way onto a playlist of a top 40 station in Washington, D.C. due to the diligence of this guy named Van Wyckoff, who used to, he wasn't the promo guy for Warner Brothers, but he worked at WEA in that area, and he just was a real champion of ours, and he'd get out there and beat the bushes for our stuff. And he managed to get Whenever You're On My Mind onto a top 40 station in the area, and it got into the top 10. Normally what happens with a record label when something like that happens is they try to spread it, you know, to other markets, you know, like they have a quote-unquote story to tell at that point, you know. But Warner's didn't do that with Whenever You're On My Mind. They just sat on their hands. And that was, you know, like a real specific kind of personal gesture on their part. Because the guy who was the head of radio promotion at the time disliked my then manager, and I think he must have disliked me also. So that's one answer as to why that record wasn't a hit.
But then they did dumb things, because I showed it to you. We're sitting here in the studio, and they put a 12-inch single.
Well, that was considered like a hip thing to do back then, you know?
So I mean, it was just louder. Because it wasn't a different mix or anything.
No.
It wasn't the top 40 single mix or anything.
No, it was just something, you know. That's how they used to promote records back then. And,
right.
You know.
It was better for the radio stations that were actually spinning vinyl still at that point, I suppose. And it lasted longer. The grooves were wider or something.
Maybe it sounds good. I don't know.
No, it does sound good.
I haven't played it, but.
It sounds good, but it was kind of odd. Have you ever thought of doing a volume 2 of Hollywood Rocks? Like, you know, because that came out in what? The book came out in 95.
Right. Yeah, you're right.
And even since then, what's gone on with soundtracks?
Yeah, sure.
I was just in Ireland, and there's this movie coming out called Intermission, and it's, of course, there's the new U2 song on there, and there's Ron Sexsmith, but then there's all, you know, the whole soundtrack thing. I know you were on Empire Records. I mean, it's such a, you know, we talked a little bit about it on the way here, but it's such a, even since then, over the past five to seven years, people are making a mint on soundtracks.
Sure, sure.
So what do you think's changed since you've written the book?
Well, you know, sure. I mean, you could do it, I guess. We could sort of pick up where we left off and add lots of stuff. Maybe correct a few things that we blew the first time around, you know. And it's still, you know, that book is still pretty widely used as a reference book, you know, for people that are interested in.
$160 on Alibris today, by the way, for a paperback copy. I saw there was a
what's that again?
A dog-eared copy was like $25, but a good condition copy of that book on one of the rare book sites, $160.
Oh, for gosh sakes, really?
Yeah, so just letting you know there's some other revenue here.
Right, well, I do have an attic. I mean, I do have a box of the things in my attic. I just give them to people if they ask me. But,
right.
You know, I mean, it is actually a good book. It's a very entertaining book, and it's informative, too, if you're interested in that kind of thing. You know, a lot of really good writing in there by other people besides me and by me also. So, I mean, it's good. It didn't really sort of... We didn't really find the right publisher for it. Again, more complaining about
just life.
Corporate show business, but
just life.
Yeah, yeah,
just the way it goes. So, digging way back, and you're probably saying, "Guy, why is this guy going this way chronologically?" San Francisco is one of the two places you spent a lot of time in Beatlemania.
True, true.
People probably don't know that whole thing. I know that whole thing, but. You played, you were the backup for Mr. Lennon, were you not? For the role of John Lennon.
Well, I guess you could put it that way, yeah. For those listening who don't know what Beatlemania was.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a Broadway show starting in about 1977. And 1977, of course, all four Beatles were still walking the earth, but they just... you know, refused to get back together. And back then, that was a really heartbreaking thing for, you know, I suppose millions of people. And these crafty entrepreneurs in New York figured out a way to put together fake, you know, like fake Beatles and kind of sell the thing as a Broadway show. And it was a big hit, you know, for a little
while.
It was huge. Yeah.
Toured everywhere.
Yeah, so after after they... achieved success on Broadway, they opened up a West Coast company starting in L.A. And I joined that company. I joined the West Coast company. There was a guy who was, you know, one of the Johns, and he hurt himself in a motorcycle accident. And while he was in the hospital, they decided to get rid of him because they didn't like the guy. So I was an understudy, so I was sent out to Hollywood, you know, and did the show at the Pantages Theater out there for a couple months, and then we came up here to San Francisco for 4 months, and that was just a fantastic time in my life, you know, and I was so enamored with San Francisco at that time, you know. I walked these streets day after day, got to really love the city, and it's always been a little sad to me that I've never had a chance to put in another stretch here or to move here or be here for another extended stay, because this is a great place to be. Whenever I do have a chance to be here, I always try to work it out so that I'm here for a few days.
Yeah, and that's our luck. That's why you're here today, because you had some extra time.
Yeah, we had a travel day yesterday and then a day off today, and then a show tomorrow up north of here, but we're going to spend the night and the day here in San Francisco. But anyway, so after that, then we went down to San Diego, did Beatlemania for a month down there, and then the West Coast Company closed. And then I was in a touring company for 6 months. And that was great, too, because, you know, I got to spend a little stretch of time here and there, you know, in various American cities, and got to really see the country. And, you know, so that was cool. I did the whole thing for about a year and a half.
Do those songs still go through your head incessantly?
No,
having
not
sung
really.
Them so many times.
Well, while I was doing the show, I got totally soured on the Beatles. You know, like mm-hmm. I just found it impossible to enjoy them during that time, and then for about maybe like a half a year after that, but that feeling went away. You know, so I'm back to being a Beatle enthusiast.
That's good. Do you think a lot of people have discovered your music through other people? And I mean, I use "Someday, Someway" by Robert Gordon as an example. Now that actually, that didn't go top 40, but you know, that was pretty much Robert's, you know, his hit, so to speak.
Well, in New York City, it was a huge radio hit. It was
Boston local. Too, because I was in Boston at the time.
Is that right?
And I remember playing it in the clubs as a dance song.
Yeah, it was. You know, it was kind of pick to click, as they say. And mm-hmm. I mean, the success that he had with it in New York was, you know, like tremendously helpful to me. because I was playing the clubs in New York by then, and then we had out a independent single in New York City at the same time Robert Gordon's thing was happening, and there was this DJ in New York who you probably heard of called Meg Griffin.
Oh, I know, yes, very much so.
Who kind of broke the Robert Gordon record in New York, and then she went on to play my independent single, which was really rare at that time, you know, for a
big
commercial
station
FM station, you know, to do that, to play a record by a local artist. But she played it to death, and so, you know, like behind all that, we really became like really, you know, we gained a lot of notoriety in New York. And somebody told me a story about the, during an A&R meeting at Warner Brothers in New York when they were trying to decide whether to sign me or not. The radio was on, and, you know, must have been, maybe it was Meg, you know, but she played Someday, Some Way and Something's Gonna Happen back to back while the A&R meeting was going on. So that Robert Gordon thing was a gigantic break for me, even though the record, it wasn't a hit for him, but it still, you know, it just, it like really gave my career a lot of momentum at that time, you know.
So let's move to now.
Yeah.
And let's talk about the new CD.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some interesting things going on there. I mean, it's very obviously there's a lot of very Marshall Crenshaw things, but then there's an interesting cover on there.
Yeah. True. Well, I mean, I think the whole record is interesting.
Yeah. Well, tell me from your perspective, because I've been playing cuts off it on the show, but I want you to tell me a little bit about what you kind of set out to do, or was there nothing you set out to do and just said, I'm going to write some more good songs and get them out there. This is the second one on Razor and Tie, isn't it? Is it the second one?
No, it's actually...
Was it the third?
Well, it's the, yeah, I did this one called Miracle of Science.
Right.
That was in 1996.
Right.
And then in 1999, I had this one out called Number 447.
Yes, which is sort of
a throwaway title for a good record that deserves a better title than that, but I couldn't think of one.
I played it, though.
Yeah, and then a couple other things along the way. There was a record that they put out of demos and
right
curios or whatever you want to call them. And
you've had the Rhino stuff out too, which is kind of fun.
That was good stuff. And so anyway, I've done, you know, I guess I've done four or five records for Razor and Tie, depending on how you want to count them.
Mm-hmm.
What was the question again?
Well, what did you set out to do? Tell people from your perspective. They're gonna hear some cuts from the album, and I've been playing it, and they're gonna say, okay, well, you know, it's a new Marshall Crenshaw record, and so I'm just curious to know what you did this time when you know, I mean, obviously you're continually writing songs.
Yeah. Well, you know, I just in the first place, I just wanted to pick up where I left off with my last record, the aforementioned number 447. I was real happy with the record, you know, and I just thought that I'd reached a kind of an interesting place, you know, with the sounds and with the songwriting and everything, and I felt really good about it. So I just thought I'd continue where I left off. There was some stuff on number 447 that was kind of jazzy and atmospheric, and you know, and that's kind of just the direction I started with, you know, for this new record. Really, you know, I just do what I do. It's all just kind of instinct. And
do you think you don't set out to do anything per se? You just keep writing songs, and whatever kind of influences you at the moment becomes kind of organic. And that's a terrible word, but you know, part of the what comes out.
Yeah. I mean, when I write something, initially, it just comes purely from an emotional place, you know? Like, I'll just, you know, like, lately when I write a song, I usually have this little portable cassette machine, and I just push play and record, and then I start playing the guitar. I try not to give it any thought in advance. And then once, you know, after that initial burst of whatever it is, you know, then I have to get into the sort of crafting it and thinking about it in a conscious way, you know, making choices about what it is or isn't going to be. But initially, it's just a burst of emotion, you know.
But you don't have a band these days, because you've been touring pretty much solo, and now this band with the two or three friends,
yeah,
so to speak.
Well, I have a band now. I mean, these guys are like,
Are they your band?
Yeah, we've been playing together since May.
Okay, and they're a band.
I love the sound that we have together, and we just have a really good connection with the three of us, you know. And so, yeah, it's kind of like a band. It's as close as I've had to having a steady band in years.
You've got some obsessed fans on I can't resist. You know, always before you do an interview, you check the message boards, and it's like, okay, Marshall's coming to San Francisco, and okay, who are the two or three friends? And then the next thing, I wrote it down. You know, it's Jeff Hill and, you know, and Jason, and Jason has a Marshall 12-watt tube amp, and they microphoned it this way. And does it amaze you that people get so obsessed with the sound of Marshall Crenshaw? Because there are a lot, and there were more than one of these, by the way. There were quite a few of these on there.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I'll have to look and see myself.
I was kind of intrigued.
I'm glad people like the stuff. I'm glad they like the show. I'm not surprised that people get excited when they see and hear us play because we're great. But it's nice. I'm glad somebody's paying attention. I've always been glad of that, you know.
So just a couple of quick things, and then we're going to play a few tunes.
Uh-huh.
What are you listening to these days? What goes in your car or on your cassette or on the bus or what this is not, you know, what you think is good music, but I mean, what's
Well, I have pretty wide-ranging tastes, and I always have, I guess. I got this one in front of me that you brought, this one called Mambo Sinuendo by Ry Cooder.
Which we're going to hear in a few minutes, yep.
Manuel Galbion. I buy a lot of records, and then whenever somebody asks me what I've been buying,
you can't remember.
Blank, but I do remember last time I went to a record store, I bought, it was right when Johnny Cash died, so I really like those Rick Rubin, Johnny Cash records a lot, so I got the last one, the latest one, you know, The Man Comes Around, it's called.
Yes.
I haven't played it yet, though, but I have it. And I also bought a record by Terrence Blanchard, trumpet player. And I haven't played that one yet either. But I got a little stockpile of records that I haven't played. And like a couple of years ago when the White Stripes, when I first heard and read about them, I kind of got intrigued by them because they were from the Detroit area.
Mm-hmm.
Or from Detroit itself, actually. And I grew up in the Detroit area also. And so I bought their, not the current one, but the last one, you know, called White Blood Cells.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of put it on the shelf and didn't listen to it for 10 or 11 months. And then I did play it, and I just loved it. So I have their current record, but I haven't played it yet.
There's a Burt Bacharach cover on there.
Well, I know that. Now, I did hear that on the radio.
Which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the guy has really good taste, Jack White.
Yeah, no,
I should say he likes stuff that I like. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no.
When you say somebody has good taste, it means they like what you like.
Yeah, exactly. You agree with them. So I wasn't going to ask this, but you know, the whole Detroit thing and your sound, which is definitely, I want to say, very well engineered. I mean, there's no question that the sound of your records is. It's simple, but it's lush. I mean, you spend a lot of time mixing your records. There's no question about it. Do you think the fact that you grew up in Detroit and you were there for, you know, Berry Gordy and all of that sort of stuff, do you think that did get into your ears and that did affect your sound?
Yeah. I'm definitely a product of the Detroit area and the musical culture of the Detroit area, definitely, you know, from... the time I was born, I was surrounded by music, and the Detroit area, you know, there's a lot of transplanted Southern people there, a lot of transplanted Southern culture, and, and a real mixture of stuff, you know, just a lot of weird social forces at work there, and my dad's family was from the South, you know, and he grew up in this Protestant church, I can't remember the name, it's some kind of Baptist church, but I mean, like, his taste initially was what influenced me. Like, he always really liked kind of earthy American stuff, you know, and I mean, he was the one who played the rock and roll station all day long, you know, from the time I was a kid. Then but you mentioned Motown, and you know, definitely I mean, it was something that I drew a lot of inspiration from, and a lot of energy from, you know, just knowing that all that stuff was happening right in my town, it was great, you know, it was really exciting.
Amazing players. I mean, and that documentary just, you know, came out recently about.
Yeah, you know,
players.
There are a lot of those records that have been kind of big chilled to death, you know,
unfortunately.
That kind of don't work anymore. They're like the 20 or 30 that are tired.
Right, if you hear Dancing in the Street by Martha Reeves and the Vandellas one more time, or, you know.
Yeah, but still, I mean, having said that, I think time has been really kind to that stuff, and it really, you know, it's just so great. What an amazing body of stuff. To me, I still marvel at it, you know. I mean, a couple of years ago, I had this really cool experience. I'm friendly with this guy named Harry Weinger, who does all the catalog reissues for Universal and for Motown.
Ah, yes.
And Harry's a nice guy. He invited me over to the studio one day to listen to some stuff they were working on, and it was for the What's Going On deluxe reissue.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yes.
So I walked in, and they were listening to this multi-track of a thing, this Marvin Gaye homecoming concert from 1973, and he punched this button and he soloed the bass track, just the bass by itself.
Wow!
And he said, who do you think this is playing? And I said, it's Jamerson. Like two notes, I knew it was Jamerson because of the way the bass buzzed and
they all had their sound. Yeah,
yeah, you know, like every great session player really has a sound that you can hear. But
the drums, I mean, in Standing in the Shadows of Motown, they made a big thing out of you. If you listen to any Motown record and you listen to the first, you know, four bars of the drums,
yeah,
you know exactly, because they each had their own, you know, their own exact opening.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, you know, that's the stuff that I loved when I was a kid. So I'll always be kind of in awe of it, you know. Motown and lots of other stuff from that time period.
So last official question, which actually works out as a great segue. I love when it actually works, when I'm actually intelligent about my questions. So when we grew up, and you and I grew up pretty much in the same period of time, which means you're still rock and rolling and I'm way too old to be doing this, but I am anyway.
Uh-huh.
What do you think the difference is between pop and what's on the radio and what gets on between when we were growing up and what's happening now? And this is not to put down anybody, but what do you think's occurred over that, you know, period of, let's say for the sake of discussion, for you and I, 30 years?
Yeah, yeah. Well, first of all, I don't have a negative attitude about contemporary music. You know, I don't just dismiss it out of hand. This time period is like all time periods, you know.
There's good and bad.
That's right. And, I mean, you know, I guess commercial radio has really changed. It's always been, you know, the law of averages is always against any record, good or bad, you know, and that's the same now as it always has been. But I mean, now with, you know, the fact that I don't even think that music directors at commercial radio stations even pretend to be that interested in the music anymore, you know.
No, research wins.
Yeah, but you know what? The thing to do is, if you don't like commercial radio, which I don't, I never ever listen to it, is just go elsewhere, because there's a lot of good stuff out there, a lot of good things, a lot of good artists.
I'd like to think so.
Trying to be heard.
I think that's why you and I are here today. So let's play a couple of tunes. Let's play two or three tunes. And Marshall and I had a conversation a little prior to this. We couldn't find everything we wanted to, so I'm going to fill in. The set after this interview is going to be, I'll have to send you a CD to prove that I did it.
Yeah.
Is going to consist of all the things that you were looking for in the stacks that didn't exist.
Oh, okay.
But luckily we had a phone conversation, and I did go home, and I did pull a few things.
Yeah, yeah.
So you want to just introduce our first artist, and then we can just kind of play a few things, and then we'll...
Yeah, well... You know, like you asked me what I wanted to play, and so like the first thing that popped into my head was to pick some favorite guitar records of mine, right? So I thought right away of this Rycooter Manuel Galbion record, and you know, I'd like to hear a couple tunes off there. And then I thought of Bo Diddley. I mean, I've been in love with Bo Diddley's sound ever since I was a kid, and it's still fresh to me. So I thought we would dig a couple of those things, and then I thought maybe we'd hear some Bill Frisell. He's a big favorite of mine. He plays on this Ginger Baker record I really like. And then I was walking down the street and I said, well, how about some 60s orchestral pop, you know, because I got the feeling from talking to you that you were kind of a 60s guy like me, you know. So I thought,
indeed.
Well, all right, why don't we hear, you know, maybe some Dionne Warwick, Burt Bacharach, or maybe some Scott Walker, or some Dusty Springfield, and
so that will be the set
stuff like that.
That will definitely be the set after this one, because I have my my Rhino Burt Bacharach box set.
Okay,
but we're gonna listen to a little Bo now.
Oh, we are. All right.
Yeah, Bo's in the CD player. So you have the CD over there. So unless you wanted to hand it to me immediately, but for the sake of whatever, we'll play a little Bo now.
All right. Well, on your box set here, it says that this is an alternate version of
I can't wait to
Hush
hear
your
it.
Mouth. So it's not the one that I know.
Oh, this is Who Do You Love first.
Oh, Who Do You Love? Yeah. All right.
Can you tell this is, well, for those of you in the listening audience, you can tell how loose this all is.
Yeah.
No, we'll do that, and then we'll do the rye, and then we'll
okay.
All right. Well, I guess I'll just hit CD player number one and see if I get some music.
Okay.
Seven miles of barbed wire. I use a cobra snake for a necktie. I got a brand new house on the roadside, made from rattlesnake hide. I got a brand new chimney made on top, made out of a human skull. Now come on, take a little walk with me, Arlene, and tell me, who do you love? 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 Tombstone hand and a graveyard mine. Just 22 and I don't mind dying. Who do you love? Who do you love? Who do you love? Who do you love? I rode around the town, use a rattlesnake whip. Take it easy, Arlie, don't give me no lip. Who do you love? Who do you love? Who do you love? Wagon flew, hit a bump and somebody screamed. You should have heard just what I see. Who do you love? Who do you love? Who do you love? Who do you love? Arlene took me by my hand. She says, ooh, wee, boy, you know I understand. Who do you love, honey? Who do you love? Who do you love?
Thank you.
crush them all. Hush him out. Oh, hush him out.
You want me to talk?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Sure.
Well, folks, that was...
Well, you know, if you're going to be a good DJ, Marshall, you got to say the call letters. You have to go 90.3 KUSF.
Oh, okay. Well, you just did it for me.
Oh, yeah, I guess I did.
90.3, like Dennis said. And that was a tune from Ry Cooter and Manuel Galbion. What's it called? Let's see. It's called Drume Negrita. Of course, I don't speak Spanish, as you can tell.
Nor do I.
But from a really beautiful CD that I like a lot called Mambo Sinuendo. And then we heard a couple by Bo Diddley. Who Do You Love? With Jody Williams on lead guitar. And kind of a weird version of Hush Your Mouth. Not one that I'd ever heard before. But there you go. And then we also heard another tune from Mambo Sinuendo called La Luna and Tu Mirada. That stuff was recorded in Havana, Cuba. A place that I still would like to see someday.
You have to go to Canada
first. As
soon
as the Bush administration's gone, maybe I can go see them.
Don't you have to
maybe
go to,
I can go see it.
You can't sneak through Canada. Isn't that what Americans do, don't you? Go to Canada and take flights from there or something.
I guess so. Do you need a visa?
I don't know. But, you know, you're up in Woodstock, so you're not, you know, you can just go over the border. And.
Oh, yeah, I can get to Canada. I can find it.
How do you get to Canada? Practice. Marshall, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. And
thank you, Dennis.
Coming up on the next set, we are going to have some Scott Walker and Dionne Warwick and Dusty Springfield.
Sounds good to me.
Okay,
it's
thanks
a good
so much.
60 stuff. All right.
Absolutely.
Be well.
You too. Bye bye.
Street and I start to cry each time we meet. Walk on by, walk on by, just let me grieve in private, 'cause each time I see you, I break down and cry. Walk on by.
Nothing like a little Dionne Warwick on 90.3 KUSF, especially when it's requested by our special interview for this Just Another Menace Sunday. Marshall Crenshaw, thanks to Marshall for dropping by the KUSF studios a while back. We did hear Dionne Warwick, Burt Bacharach's Walk On By, Walker Brothers, The Sun Ain't Gonna Shine Anymore, both a request by Marshall Crenshaw. Well, there it is, part one, hour number one of Just Another Menace Sunday with yours truly, Dennis the Menace. If you like what you're hearing or have any special requests for people you'd like us to interview, we're going to be doing this for weeks and weeks and weeks on end. Simply write to Dennis at menaceattic.com, MENACEATTIC.com. Next week's interview, Scottish, and he is willing to wear this badge I'm about to say, Scottish power pop genius, Mull Historical Society, with the world premiere in the United States of some tracks from his new CD. Well, we have a little business to take care of. We're going to do that right now. And then we'll be back with hour number two of Just Another Menace Sunday, the new music.
Supergen Incorporated reminds the women of our community to have screening mammograms at recommended intervals. Today's low-dose, state-of-the-art mammography can detect tumors too small to be discovered by touch. Early diagnosis can mean that you'll have better than a 95% chance of successful treatment. Don't delay. Schedule your appointment today at the hospital or clinic of your choice. Your appointment may save your life. This important reminder is brought to you by Supergen Incorporated in Dublin, on the air because they care about the health of the women in our community.
Don't miss the summer gardening fair at the Stribing Arboretum. I knew I was going to mess that up. The Botanical Gardens in Golden Gate Park. On Saturday, August 7th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., the entry garden will be blooming with activities, demonstrations, plants to buy, and more. It's a great place to meet members from a wide range of plant clubs. I know you've been dying to do that in organizations. Whether you're interested in roses or rare fruit, want to learn how to grow a begonia, or build a birdhouse, the Summer Gardening Fair will have experts on hand. Call 415-661-1316 for details. Well, there we are. It's time for hour number two of Just Another Menace Sunday. Allison, hit CD number two.